From the newsroom of PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Pahon. The French President Emmanuel Macron is making his first visit to New Caledonia this week, 6 months before the territory's vote on independence from France. Mr. Macron plans to mark his three-day visit, which starts Saturday, with symbolic acts, but in the same tense political climate, of late they are controversial. Walter Zweifel has been following the build-up to the visit. Koro Vakawata asked him, what are some of the issues?
The main point of friction revolves around Mr. Macron's planned visit this Saturday of the grave of the 19 Kanaks killed in the 1988 Ouvéa hostage drama. For weeks, the Gossena tribe on Ouvéa has made it known that they don't want him at the tomb. There have been protests and banners against him visiting the tomb, and attempts to change their minds have so far failed. The Ouvéa hostage crisis was a turning point in the troubles of the 1980s because the shock of that clash brought about a truce, which has lasted three decades and ultimately led to shelving all this independence question until this year.
So what is his position on independence?
When campaigning for the presidency last year, he spoke out for New Caledonia to stay French, saying there could be no rupture to the common history. He made that statement days before the runoff against Marine Le Pen, who in the first round had won almost three times more votes than him. He did narrowly defeat her in the second round, but in pockets of Noumea, she had 70% of the votes. Now, as president, he's expected to be neutral between the pro and anti-independence camps and let the electorate decide.
However, Emmanuel Macron has also spoken out against colonialism.
Yes, during the campaign last year when he visited Algeria, he said French colonization was a crime against humanity. This line has been picked up by the customary Kanak Senate. It now wants him to recognize the legitimacy of the Kanak chiefly structure, whose powers were taken away when France seized the island in 1853. The parallel is interesting in as far as Algeria and New Caledonia were the only two colonies designated for settlement. And as a quirk of history, some French people forced out of Algeria moved to New Caledonia. And incidentally, the most influential local politician, that is Philippe Gomez, was born in Algeria.
Now, Paris has announced that Mr. Macron will return the original deed with which France took possession. Why?
It's not quite clear, as nobody seemed to have asked for it. Some anti-independence politicians say the time for this is not right and suggest this goes against the majority who wants to stay with France. However, a pro-independence leader, Rocco Amiton, says he assumes that by handing over the document, he also returns New Caledonia's independence.
And now there's a rally as well?
Yes, it seems to go with just about all visits of top French leaders in New Caledonia. This is an occasion for the blue, white and red crowd to take to the streets to show pride to be French. However, the small and insignificant local chapter of his En Marche party has called for the public not to join the march, which has been called for midday Friday in central Noumea.
There are calls for capital punishment in Vanuatu after the brutal killing of a six-year-old girl 2 weeks ago. Police are still investigating, but so far they have charged one man who is in custody. As Corey Hawkins reports, the case has stirred up the debate about justice in the country.
Florence Yorel's body was found by her uncle near a creek 30 minutes from the family home on the island of Tana. It is alleged the six-year-old was abducted, raped, and then brutally murdered. Although the full coroner's report has not been released, police confirmed Florence died from multiple injuries to her body. The victim's family is now calling for capital punishment, abolished by Vanuatu in 1980, to be reintroduced for such crimes. The chief executive of the Vanuatu National Council of Women, Leas Colwick, fully supports the family, saying serious deterrents are long overdue.
The country needs to have a death penalty, because now the issues that have happened recently with very innocent young children, it's just not acceptable. We have discussed these issues as well, and being a Christian country, it doesn't give you the right to go killing anybody. So we need to have a deterrent in place to make sure that people's lives and their livelihood is respected.
The chairperson of the Vanuatu Christian Council, Pastor Alan Nafuki, says he will be calling a meeting to discuss the issue this week, but he says, personally, he feels there is no place for capital punishment in Vanuatu.
In a Christian perspective and also a Catholic perspective, we are not allowed. We are saying no to capital punishment. So This will be picked up by the government, but as far as I understand, people are not in favor. Even the chiefs of these islands and our custom identity does not recognize that.
The chairperson of Vanuatu Women Against Crime and Corruption, Jenny Ligo, says Vanuatu needs stricter enforcement of existing laws.
The parents, their child is dead. So they have a right to make that call. And it's upon the decision makers now to do what they feel is better for Vanuatu. I think women of Vanuatu, we would like our lawmakers to do the right thing. They have to make sure that our laws are enforced to make sure that Vanuatu is safe.
A man has been charged over the killing and he's being held in police custody. This is Kuroi Hawkins.
60 years after Britain conducted its large nuclear test in what is now Kiribati, veterans who were there are continuing to demand recognition and compensation. Unlike the United States and France, Britain remains the only power to insist its tests in the Pacific were clean and caused no ill effects. But as Britain tries to return to the Pacific, pitching itself as a benevolent power, many are saying it's time for Britain to own up to its own nuclear legacy. Jamie Tahana reports.
It was 1958, the Cold War. Britain was in the last gasp of empire, looking to still foot it as a great power. It was building a hydrogen bomb, and rebuffed by Australia and New Zealand, it set up a station on its Pacific colony, Christmas Island, to try it out.
Waiting to make history. For Britain's first hydrogen bomb is about to be exploded. From this day, Britain will rank beside America and Russia as a major nuclear power. From the moment that the white-painted Valiant bomber takes off with its deadly load, Britain is no longer dependent on anyone for this ultimate deterrent.
Some 14,000 troops were sent to Christmas Island, including two New Zealand frigates and 276 personnel from Fiji, which was also then a British colony. Among those deployed in 1958 was a 20-year-old Fijian, Paul Apoi.
We were told that we were going to do sea training, that's all, and we were eager because we were young. We were glad to go out. We went to Christmas Island. When we got there, we found out they told us that they're going to test the nuclear weapons. We didn't even know what a nuclear weapon was. There was no word for nuclear in the Fijian language. There's no word for radiation. We didn't know what it was.
Mr. Apoi says he was on Christmas Island for seven detonations with little protection, including for the largest, the 3-megaton Grapple Y. On the 28th of April 1958, Mr. Apoi and hundreds of others were herded onto the beach, told to face away, crouch, and cover their eyes.
We had the palm of our hand over our eyes. I could see, I closed my eyes, I still could see the skeleton of my fingers through my closed eyelid, and then I was squirming because I thought my shirt was going to burst into flames.
The British authorities insist their operations were well planned and every measure was taken to ensure the safety of both personnel and locals. Every member was kept at a safe distance, they say, and given a device, film badges, to monitor the levels of radiation they were exposed to. Paul Apoi says that's not true.
They seem to pick up only a certain group of people to wear protective gear. I wasn't given any protective gear, no film to record the dose of radiation, nothing at all. So it looks like we were guinea pigs. Where did all the officers disappear to on that day? And the scientists, they were in the bunker, while all the ordinary sailors, soldiers and airmen were lined up on the beach.
Nick McClellan, an Australian author who recently published a book on British nuclear testing, says many of the film badges were never processed. Many of the records remain top secret, but he says there's a great deal of evidence to suggest that many of the precautions written up in London never made it to Christmas Island. Mr. McClellan says corners were also cut as Britain raced to beat a growing groundswell against nuclear testing.
There's also a lot of evidence found in the archives to show that the British cut corners on safety creating a danger zone that removed inhabited islands, neighbouring islands, from the supposed danger zone. And so they knew that there were hazards for the small Micronesian populations, and yet they went ahead with the tests regardless.
Mr. Apoi returned to Fiji in mid-1958. A few months later, his hair started to fall out. Other veterans experienced the same. Some developed cancers at a young age. Others struggled to have children, including Mr. Apoi.
I had two, a boy and a girl. My daughter cannot, she was quite normal. She was a beautiful girl. My boy is normal, but today he cannot have children. But the girl, she died when she was 3.5 years.
He says no one seriously linked their health issues to their experience at the nuclear test sites for several decades. But in 1999, a Fiji teacher went on an exchange to the Marshall Islands, where the US conducted its testing, and saw the effects on locals there. She arranged a gathering of Fiji veterans, and their stories were the same. Many could not have children, and if they did, they had genetic issues. Several had cancer. Many were already dead. And so, a decade-long fight began in the British courts, with the Ministry of Defence fighting every step of the way to the Supreme Court in London. Today, Britain remains the only power that continues to maintain that its tests were clean and caused no ill effect. Both the United States and France have set up compensation schemes, albeit deficient ones. Mr. McClellan says Britain's stance is incomprehensible.
This is the tragedy of the British position. Other nuclear powers who tested in the Pacific, the United States and France, have acknowledged, belatedly, that there were health effects and have set up systems for compensation both for health and environmental damage. The British refuse to acknowledge their responsibility, and this continues to this day.
On the 60th anniversary, as their health deteriorates and their numbers dwindle, the veterans of Britain's Pacific nuclear tests are still fighting for recognition and compensation. At a recent Commonwealth gathering, Britain, in search of friends as it leaves the EU, spoke of its plans to return to the Pacific as a benevolent power. Mr. McClellan says cleaning up its nuclear legacy could be a good place to start. This is Jamie Tahana.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Maori elders have performed a traditional service at a graveside ceremony in the American Samoa just before the repatriation of the remains of a New Zealand sailor. The Royal New Zealand Navy engineer, Russell Moore, is the third member of New Zealand's Defence Force to be disinterred as part of the project to return those buried overseas back home. Sally Round reports.
Russell Moore was killed in 1956 when heavy equipment crushed him as he was working on the dock in Pangopango. He was 19 and had sailed to American Samoa on the survey vessel HMNZS Lachlan. The leader of the Defence Force's repatriation project, Te Auraki, Group Captain Carl Nixon, explained the ceremony at Satala Cemetery.
We're saying what we call karakia prayers at the gravesite for Russell Moore before we disinter him. But there are a number of other traditional prayers that were said at the same time. And we're talking to all of the cemetery and we're talking to the country as well, saying thank you very much for looking after our sailor and we're now ready to take him home.
May the Lord God who makes all things holy and whole, make you also holy.
The ceremony for Russell Moore follows the disinterment of Royal New Zealand Air Force Flight Lieutenant George Beban and Fireman Leading Aircraftman Ralph Scott from Fiji last week. In Pangopango, representatives from the US Army Reserve attended the blessing alongside Maori elders.
We always travel with our kamatoa and kuia, and they are the elders that are clearing the way for us and keeping us safe. And then we have the forensic team. There's a 7-person forensic team involved in the project as well.
A forensic and archaeology team was involved with the disinterment with the help of local workers. Russell Moore's identity will be confirmed at a US Army Reserve facility in the territory.
We will take the remains back to a private facility where he will be identified and just confirmed that he is Sailor Moore before we prepare his remains into a casket that's come from New Zealand.
Group Captain Carl Nixon says Royal New Zealand Navy sailors will stand guard throughout the process.
Once Sailor Moore has been placed into the casket, they will conduct a 24/7 continuous vigil on that casket.
Russell Moore is one of 37 servicemen and dependents that are expected to be repatriated this year. His remains will be returned to New Zealand on Sunday morning. This is Sally Round.
Kiribati is set to get its first television station with Wave TV, expected to kick off services within a few months. The station plans to provide at least 20 pay and free view channels to 1,000 homes on the main island of Tarawa. And then they will reassess the feasibility of rolling it out throughout the country. Wave TV will be assisted by the Papua New Guinea-based Click Pacific, who have experience operating in both PNG and Fiji. Click Pacific's Richard Broadbridge told Koro Vakawato, the station will allow Aikiribati to see themselves on TV, but he says it will also connect them with communities from abroad.
These people out there with no real, apart from radio, access to, you know, much of the free content that exists in our part of the world, especially content that's coming out of Pacifica through TVNZ, out of Australian Network. So at least there's now an opportunity for those people to access these programs. So we did a couple of surveys. We've been to Kiribati. We've signed an agreement. The gear has been ordered. And our engineers are scheduled to be there for the end of July, early August, to start the installation.
There's the technical side of it, that sort of thing, but are there other kind of facets to your involvement in terms of content and production, that sort of thing?
We're a broadcast in Papua New Guinea. We have a local channel that we broadcast with. We have a newsroom. We have multiple pay TV channels in Papua New Guinea. So naturally, we'll be able to pass on some of the skills, that knowledge to local staff. We will have a manager on the ground to train people. Obviously, we are very keen to assist them by way of setting up a local content. And we've assigned Channel 1 as a local channel, so it would not only be content produced by the station, but I suspect we'll be encouraging local content providers to participate in the exercise. So it's not only good for in terms of health, education, politics, parliament, all that sort of stuff, but it gives those people there in Kiribati access to local faces, local issues. I think it's a very positive thing for the country.
The experience, I think, since in the last 4 or 5 years that you've had in Papua New Guinea, how will that be reflected in what you do in Kiribati? Is it going to be kind of a template used there?
You know, I've never been one to use a template in one country and try and reflect it into another, because as we all know, in the Pacific Islands, you simply cannot expect one economy to behave like another. PNG is another large economy and beast on its own. We have the advantage of operating in Fiji before this. It's a much smaller economy. We have to think small when we're getting into Kiribati. We've got a number of issues to deal with in regards to billing and how people pay us. Obviously, it's a much smaller operation to deal with, so the Fijian experience would be very helpful.
You mentioned some challenges. What are the difficulties in spreading broadcasting across, I guess, such a vast country as Kiribati, with atolls kind of scattered throughout the ocean?
In Tarawa itself, the major challenge would be the height of the coconut tree. So that's one of the things that, in terms of broadcasting, we have to get different types of antenna installation to the homes, because not all homes are made of brick. So we've got a number of options to deal with on the ground. There's also in regards to sending traffic from the main playout to the main transmission area or to the homes. How do we do that? How do we, in terms of planning for our future, ensuring that the technology will be able to adapt to other products that will be attaching to the same system in the future? Now, in terms of the rest of the country, I think we have to think satellite for that. It's just it's going to be impossible to try and roll out digital terrestrial in all these atolls. So what we're trying to do is to see, first of all, where the major population is, ensure that it is a working and profitable business before we start looking at other parts of the country.
Papua New Guinea's Prime Minister has lashed out at a new report saying the country has not benefited from its huge ExxonMobil-led liquefied natural gas project. The report by social justice NGO Jubilee Australia said that $19 billion of the project had failed to create jobs or spin-offs for PNG's economy, despite big promises by political backers. Exxon has defended its side of the arrangement, while the government has linked the project's lower-than-expected revenues to the global oil slump price. Johnny Blades has more.
The Jubilee report says ExxonMobil's project has had mostly negative economic impacts for PNG since gas exports began in 2014. A co-author of the report, economist Paul Flanagan, says that on the projections of rapid growth and an influx of easy money from the project, the government went on a spending spree from 2013 to 2015, which has since crippled the economy.
In terms of the economic impacts, the promises of a doubling of the size of the economy, massive increases in employment and government expenditure, those items just haven't happened, even on the measure of GDP. Instead of doubling, the results indicate there's been a negligible improvement. And all of that has actually gone to the oil and gas extraction sector. The rest of the economy has actually gone backwards.
The Prime Minister, Peter O'Neill, used yesterday's speech at a PNG Australia Business Forum meeting in Brisbane to respond. He said experts aligning themselves with political interests had been continually talking down PNG's economy.
And continue to release in fake news. And in one particular comment recently, they said, I quote, currently on almost every measure of economic welfare in 2016, PNG would have been better off without the PNG LNG project. Now, those kind of assessment is just an utter nonsense.
PNG's National Planning Minister Richard Maru says there are some basic reasons why the project's projected revenue windfall hasn't materialised.
But you must also understand, we borrowed money. The investors also borrowed and they have to retire loans they used to fund the project. At the moment, they have been going through that phase. While that's going on, the price obviously came right down. So that also impacted on cash flows and the profitability of the LNG business in Papua New Guinea. But the prices are going up now, and we are quite excited about the next few years.
Meanwhile, Exxon has issued a statement defending the social and economic benefits it says it's bringing to PNG.
Nearly 2,600 employees and contractors are engaged in PNG LNG production operations. Approximately 82% are Papua New Guinean and 22% are women. In local communities, we've invested more than $246 million to build infrastructure, develop social programs, and implement skills training. Our efforts have a tangible and direct impact on the community.
But Jubilee's report says most landowners in the Highlands project area still haven't been paid royalties or benefits they were promised. According to Exxon, royalty payments due to the government have been ongoing since gas production started in 2014.
Payment and distribution of royalties and other benefits due to landowners in the project area is the responsibility of the PNG government.
The issue of non-payment of dues to landowners in the project's hub around the gas fields of Hela Province remains explosive, particularly with the lingering threat by landowners to shut the project down if their interests aren't met. This is Johnny Blades.
The leaders of Micronesia have agreed to the key resolutions tabled last week at a summit of the areas of fishery, climate change, transportation and health. Palau, the federal states of Micronesia, and Marshall Islands, the governors of the Northern Mauritius and Guam, plus the leaders of each of the federated states attended the three-day summit, that is, held in Saipan. Our correspondent in the Northern Mauritius, Mark Rabago, told Sarah Vitulu more about what they agreed to.
It ranges from shifting distribution of tuna stocks and other climate change impacts on food security. There was also something on combating illegal, unregulated, and unreported fishing in Micronesia. There's also something about for transportation and also for economic development.
Oh, what's the one for transportation?
They needed some help from the ESDOT, that's Department of Transportation. They wanted something like to give them a grant of waivers so they could have an average or fewer than 10 employments per day to permit eligibility of these locations to the Essential Air Service Program. Because I think the U.S. has like a monopoly. U.S. carriers could only service the CNMI, Fast States and Guam to a certain extent. They cannot allow too much foreign carriers here because there's a decline in service provided by, as I said, U.S. flag carriers. They want to open up competition by opening the region for air transportation services from foreign countries. What happened to Delta Airlines, pulling out, United Airlines scaling back.
What about climate change?
On the climate change, they said according to the studies, within 20 years, the distribution of tuna stocks may begin to shift towards Central and Eastern Pacific, and the population or human consumption of these fish stocks will grow 10 to 15%. So because of the shift, they want international collaboration on policies and action aimed at addressing climate change and prevent food fish gaps and ensure food security, especially for Micronesia. Help in solving the rise in sea levels and the shift in distribution of tuna stocks that would affect the regions, or the population of the regions, access to these fish stocks, because they are anticipating within 20 years it would move from the Western Pacific towards the Central and Eastern Pacific. So they're afraid that they may not have this access to those tuna fish stocks.
What about healthcare?
They had something about telemedicine and telehealth. So they want to expand telehealth and telemedicine. Of course, they want higher speeds of internet service. So they need the U.S.'s help, the federal government's help in having faster internet service. Of course, with the faster internet service, it includes fiber optic cables, access to cloud and mobile-based applications, and enhancing local capabilities and systems to support telemedicine, telehealth. So that means infrastructure build-up, probably current technology and IT infrastructure. They would have to develop those and increase the capacity, and has to be cost-prohibitive, not too expensive.
So we've got fishing, transport, climate change, health.
Okay. Here's another one. On climate change, they have something on the climate change, something to do with the Paris Agreement. So the Paris Agreement, there's a clause there that there shouldn't be any rise in the climate from 1.5 degrees Celsius. There should be a limit. The CNMI and its other states of Micronesia are in agreement with that Paris Agreement statement that the temperature rise should not be 1.5 degrees Celsius or higher. Obviously, this is because of climate change and the rising of sea level. So weather, extreme weather events, sea level rise, and ocean acidification are factors or happening because of the rise in temperature. So the CNMI and the other MIF states, the forums, the attendees of the forum want to adhere to this limit.
And that's all we have time for on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you wish to get in touch with us to let us know how you heard the program, do so, focus@pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Perron, wishing you well, saying so long, take care. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.